Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
In today's episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we have a special interview guest. It's science writer Mary Roach. We're going to be chatting with her about her new book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, which is out today wherever you get your books.
This is my first Mary Roach book, and I love it. I feel ashamed now that I had never read one of her books before, but she has such an infectious and enjoyable prose style that really gets in your head. One of the things that I wanted to emphasize in the intro here, because I had just been thinking about it, in terms of subject matter, this book gets into a lot of kind of dark and grisly sounding stuff, but it is... But despite that, it is a really funny book. It is like one of the most laugh-out-loud funny books I've read in a long time.
Yeah, it's engaging, it's weird, it's fun. I was telling my wife about the book, and she's read Mary Roach before, mm-hmm. and my wife was like, well, some of that sounds a little dark. I don't know if I want to read that right now. But of course, this has always been the way with Mary Roach books. They do get into dark territory, but they are always fun and humorous. If you're not familiar out there, her previous books include 2003 Stiff, which is about cadavers, 2005 Spook, which is about scientific inquiries, especially early scientific inquiries into the supernatural, 2008's Bonk, which is about sexuality, 2010's Packing for Mars, which is about the scientific research into the quest for space, 2013's Gulp, which is about human digestion, then 2016's book was Grunt, which is about military scientific investigations. I've read all of these, and I think this is the fourth time Mary has actually been on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, as she previously dropped in to talk about Packing for Mars, Gulp, and Grunt. She's either our most featured guest at this point, or she's tied for the honors. I can't remember. Either way, friend of the show status is definitely in place.
Mary Roach, thanks for joining us today. Could you introduce yourself?
Of course. I'm Mary Roach. As you said, I'm a nonfiction author, and my most recent book is called Fuzz. The subtitle is When Nature Breaks the Law.
I have been so enjoying this book. I love your dry, humorous prose style in it. And I thought before we got to any broader questions about the book and what you've learned from writing it, I thought it would be good to kick off with an example of the kinds of experiences you cover in the book. And so I loved the story you cover in the very first chapter about the wildlife human attack response training course you went through in Las Vegas. Could you tell us a bit about this conference and what got you there and what it was like?
Sure. It's called Wildlife Human Attack Response Training, or WART. which by its founder's admission is a terrible acronym. So WART is a 5-day course, which I was lucky enough to be able to sit in on. And it's almost entirely attended by people who deal with wildlife attacks, the aftermath of the attack. And it's basically, you're setting up a crime scene and you're doing forensics as you might in the case of a human-on-human killing. And you're trying to take evidence, collect evidence, establish linkage between the perpetrator and the victim. And if they've caught an animal that they think might be the animal and the DNA doesn't match, or they're not able to establish that linkage, they'll release the animal. So there's these bizarre parallels to the human criminal justice system. But for me, it was just a fascinating 5 days of hanging out and hearing a lot about predator attacks and the aftermath, which was both fascinating and often quite grisly. GRIS, not ZZ. it was utterly fascinating to me because I've never encountered this world and did not know that these crime scenes were processed that way and that this work was done.
Yeah, so you include some details about these sessions where you would be given a mannequin that had these wounds inflicted on it with saws and knives and things, and you'd have to establish what type of animal it was from the wounds on the mannequin.
Yeah, Yeah. They had these soft touch mannequins. They're not like something you'd see in a store window. They were, you know, they're fleshy, I'll say fleshy. And they were the people who had created these wounds for people who've seen them. I mean, they were based on actual bodies and the wounds on the victims of attacks. Some of them bear, some of them cougar or mountain lion. Quite realistic, I have to say. And so they were, we all had workstations, you know, there were about I think eight or more, maybe a few more workstations. Each group had a mock victim. And the idea was, look at these wounds and what can you learn? And you can pretty quickly make a distinction between, first of all, human versus animal, and then mountain lion versus bear. They kill in very different ways. They have very different teeth and claws, and the marks on the body and the wounds will tell you quite readily who the perpetrator or what species the perpetrator was. And then after that is established, then you sort of, you're moving down to more the nitty gritty of looking at saliva, you know, matching DNA between the victim and the animal. So you might be doing that with saliva on the victim's body, or blood. You might be looking into the gums of the animal to see if is there human tissue there, and does that match, you know, the victim. So you'd be, you did just like you might do on, you know, CSI or one of those shows that I never watch, but those forensic shows. So super interesting stuff.
One of the details from the section that really stuck with me was, and warning to everyone, this is about to get gruesome, the idea of, since bears tend to, when they do attack humans, which is rare, but when they do, they tend to bite repeatedly at the face that you might expect to, say, find human facial features like lips or something stuck in the bear's teeth.
Or the stomach. You would examine the bear's stomach contents, and they're not necessarily chewing all that thoroughly. And so you might find, you know, an entire eye, or in one case, a part of the scalp with a mohawk haircut, and which in fact matched the victim's hairstyle. So with bears, because bears, when they attack each other, they use their teeth and go for the face. They go for each other's face because that's lightly furred and they can inflict more damage. And that's their kind of Achilles heel, which is in their their head, not their foot. That's kind of what they do, and when that's, which makes for some pretty horrible injuries. You see that also, you know, with cougars, because they're biting at the neck. But sometimes, you know, when I use the comparison again, rather grisly, but when you think of biting into a very ripe plum, how when you bite into it, the skin pulls away. So what you sometimes have is kind of these scalpings, as it were, because, you know, if you're an animal and you're trying to get your jaw around a human head, you're hitting bone right away, and then you close your jaws and it pulls the skin away. So some of these mannequins were really a little tough to see, and I can imagine coming upon the real thing would be pretty disturbing.
But one of the interesting things that is a takeaway from observing all these different kinds of wounds is that almost all of them indicate that we are not really what this animal has evolved to use its jaws or claws on. And so, like you described with the cougars biting the back of the head or bears attacking humans, the bites almost reveal the strangeness of this encounter between the human and the animal.
Right. A bear's... eat. I mean, they're mostly eating nuts, berries, fruit, sometimes fish, grasses. So they have molars that they have a jaw that goes side to side, and they've got molars for crushing and grinding. So the bites on a human, it's messy, is the way it was put. It's kind of a messy affair, whereas a mountain lion leaps, attacks, secures the prey, does a killing bite. So these puncture wounds, these triangular puncture wounds, it's a less messy death, if you will. So yeah, you can really see how the animal is equipped to gather its food. And with mountain lions, yeah, they do tend to, they pounce and kill. They are predators and true carnivores, but we're not on the menu You know, they like deer or wild pigs, or they're not going after humans very, very rarely. A whole decade will go by in California where we don't have a single mountain lion fatality. It's just a very unusual occurrence.
Now, speaking of bears, I really enjoyed the how not only with the bear chapter, but, you know, multiple chapters in the book, you kind of you turn our pre-existing notions of these animals kind of on their head, even if we think that our pre-existing notions are kind of, you know, well-informed. But with the bear in particular, when you're talking about the break-ins that are, you know, perpetrated by bears in these cases, how it seems like the bear is such a contradiction. Can you speak to, like, some of those details about, like, how reckless they can be, but then so how just almost hauntingly precise?
Sure. Yeah. I spent some time in Pitkin County, Colorado, on the outskirts of downtown Aspen, up in the hills. And this is a ski resort town. We're up in the mountains. We are in bear territory. And so the bears are, the bears start to realize, you know, nuts and berries, these are great. Crab apples, chokecherry, this is great. But these humans seem to have some really good stuff inside their homes. And a bear that kind of realizes that is surprisingly adept at popping a window or even turning, they call them bear handles. They're French door handles, which you just push down on and push the door and it opens quite easily. So bears are find it very easy to get into people's homes. And people are sometimes surprised. I mean, it depends on the bear, but some bears, like the break-in that where I went to the aftermath of this break-in, and the bear had gone through a downstairs, through a deck leading to a bedroom downstairs, and then up to the kitchen, didn't knock anything over, didn't even leave footprints. Some bears, the guy who the wildlife invest, it was Colorado Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife, he was talking about how they'll sometimes reach in, like take out a carton of eggs and set it aside, or take out things that they don't want and put them aside. One bear allegedly opened a Hershey's Kiss, opened the foil on a Hershey's Kiss, and ate that. So while they can create, you know, a god awful mess, whether it's on a body or in someone's kitchen, sometimes they're surprisingly precise and laid back. It's interesting how different their individual personalities are.
Was it from the person you were speaking with at Colorado Fish and Wildlife that you got that fact about, or at least the allegation that some of these bears apparently have brand preferences when it comes to ice cream? Like they really like Haagen-Dazs, but they don't like the store brand.
Yes, it was. It was a woman from the neighboring town. Is it Snowmass? I think it's a mountain resort, a ski and mountain biking resort town. Tina White, I believe her name was, and she said that the black bears in the area, they prefer premium brands. They will not touch Western Family ice cream, which I guess is like a low rent brand that they have in Colorado. Uh-huh. And they're like, no, thank you.
I got to say, the parts of that chapter where you were talking about the bears getting into the trash, the unsecured trash outside of fancy restaurants, that was really making me hungry when you were listing all the foods they were stabbing their snouts into. So the rotten burrata cheese and the salmon.
The sustainable Sukuna salmon. And exactly. They were like, this is some good eating.
Let's go a little broader for a second here and just talk about the book itself, which again is Fuzz, when Nature Breaks the Law. I was just wondering how long have you been planning this particular book, and is there anything in particular that you can point to as being like the inspiration point that led you down this road?
Oh, I wish I had a great origin story, because people often ask about that, and I came to this one in it's a really kind of circuitous roundabout, not necessarily all that interesting path. I had originally gotten interested in wildlife crime scene forensics, but not when the animals are the perpetrators, but when the animals are the victims. So I was up at this forensics lab that the Fish and Wildlife Department has, talking to this woman who is an expert in how to tell counterfeit versus genuine dried tiger penis. because of course it's illegal to traffic in animal endangered animal parts. And as it turns out, almost always what's being passed off as tiger penis is deer or horse or cow, partly because those are easier to come by and they're bigger and more impressive. And if you're trying to quote unquote cure erectile dysfunction or make yourself more virile, a little tiger penis doesn't have the right optics. Anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying I was up at this lab, the Fish and Wildlife, National Wildlife Forensics Laboratory. And I thought, well, this could be an interesting area, but as it turns out, I was not going to be able to follow any open investigations. I wasn't going to be able to tag along with investigators and do the kind of thing I really have to do for my books to make it interesting for myself, hopefully for the reader. So that was a dead end. And I kind of various other things happened, but I eventually thought, well, what if I turn it around? And what if the animals were the perpetrators and the people are the victims? And you know, what's to be done there? And I learned that there's in fact a whole science that's devoted to this called human-wildlife conflict. That is the science of human-wildlife conflict. And there's conventions and scientists and researchers. So I thought that could be an interesting world to step into. So it was a circuitous path. It wasn't, I have not been attacked, or not until the book, by any animal.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You were robbed by a monkey.
I was mugged by a macaque. Yes, I was.
So when I picked up the book and was getting into it, you know, I expected a lot of it, of course, to be happening in a contemporary setting and dealing with our modern world, thinking like, okay, this is where the legal system has led, and this is where, you know, the growth of human populations and expansion has led. So I was really surprised and interested when you mentioned a book from 1906, The Criminal Prosecution and Punishment of Animals by, I believe, E.P. Evans. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure. That's something I came upon very early on, and that also pushed me toward this topic. A bizarre book. This is a book detailing the things that human societies used to do to deal with animals and insects that were committing crimes against them. Crimes in the sense of, you know, following our laws, you know, stealing or committing manslaughter. And what used to happen is that they were criminally prosecuted. The example I give in the book is this case. It's from 1659 in Northern Italy, a province in Northern Italy, and caterpillars were eating a lot of the crops, lettuces, whatever they were, as caterpillars will do. They're hungry. They've got to, you know, bulk up for their little transition. And so the community, whoever the magistrate or the head person was, posted summons, legal summons on the trees in the area, requesting that the caterpillars appear in court on a set date, at which point the summons said they would be assigned legal representation and a trial would ensue. And of course, the caterpillars did not appear in court, but by that time had pupated, weren't causing any problems anymore. But that's this book. It's like 400 pages of well-documented situations and cases. There were, you know, a livestock, some of it pigs killing small children, not, we don't hear about that happening much today, but apparently it used to happen with some frequency, the pigs being tried, executed, sometimes imprisoned. And I thought this, I almost thought this was a hoax because it was so bizarre. But the appendix has a number of these documents in some detail in Latin, a lot of the time, sometimes French. And so it was real. And it was not that there were just simple-minded people. It was the way the author explained it. It was a way to display the breadth of your powers as a legal entity or as a leader. You know, even nature must follow my rules, and you will be punished. So it's kind of a display, kind of ludicrous, but a display of dominion and power, and I control all. But the details were quite amazing. I mean, people. Writs, W-R-I-T, writs of ejectment that were stuffed into the burrows of rats. Like, you must leave the, you must vacate the premises under penalty of law. Obviously, legal system, not the best approach with animals. They don't read. They don't care. They just want a place to have a nest or get something to eat. And we offer that and they take advantage of it. These are crimes of opportunity for the most part. Anyway, that book is a fascinating, if not particularly easy to get through, but a fascinating read. 1906 is when that book was published.
Do you think these kinds of legal actions were at all based on a certain theological understanding of law? I don't recall any mention of this in the book, but you know, was there an idea that maybe if you issued a certain kind of a legitimate sanctioned by the court that somehow God would enforce it or something?
Yeah, yes, there definitely was a religious element. There was this sense, this belief that these plagues and these actions of these animals were a punishment on the people themselves, that God was punishing us by sending these creatures. So yeah, that was tied into it. There was a belief that we, the community, are being punished. And so, you know, we will, I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what you were asking, but that was definitely part of the belief.
But on the subject of theology and religion, you do later in the book get into that a bit, talking to individuals about like what is one's religious responsibility towards these animals that we may think of as vermin.
Well, I spent some time in India, which has quite a different attitude and relationship. You know, attitude toward animals and relationship with them, partly because a lot of the deities in Hinduism are animals, or they're, you know, they appear as animals, or the spouse is an animal, or they ride around on an animal, or they themselves, like Hanuman is the monkey head, and Ganesh the elephant. Cows are considered sacred. So it's when those animals start to cause problems, people are not as quick to rush in to call in the authorities to exterminate them or cull them. And there's a stigma attached to that. And, you know, New Delhi, the tremendous problems with macaques, troops of macaques, not just Delhi, all over cities in northern India, macaques cause a lot of problems. And one of the things that's done in New Delhi is to catch them and transport them down to this large sanctuary in the southern part of the city. It used to be a mine, and now it's rewilded and is a place where the macaques are let loose. And it's very, very hard for the authorities to hire monkey catchers. I mean, that's just you would be looked at askance if you were somebody who was trapping and manhandling macaques because of the religious significance of these animals. The other thing going on, while they're pests and nuisances to people, that people are also they gather at temples, these monkeys, because they know people will, and offerings they will not only inside the temple where, you know, the more conventional offerings are made, but when they go outside, they see the monkey and they will give the monkey, you know, fruit or little packets of soda or whatever, and they're both encouraging the animal and then also being harassed by it. So it's a sticky problem there. The religious elements make it more complicated when it comes to finding some sort of solution.
There are several examples in the book where you discuss animals that in some way interact or have conflict with or live alongside humans, and how there might be a sort of emergent evolutionary pressure on animals that know how to exploit humans and just to the right extent without overstepping and then being dealt with violently. Like you talk about this in the chapter with the bears, which I thought was really interesting, how there could be a kind of evolutionary advantage for what are called the fat Albert bears, the bears that are, you know, get in and get a lot of calories out of your fridge, but are less likely to have a scary conflict with a person or less likely to damage the house.
Right. Yeah. Fat Albert was a bear that was quite good at breaking into people's cabins and homes. This is again, Colorado. But people would marvel afterwards, like, came in here, didn't damage anything. I mean, people were kind of impressed, you know, okay, raided the fridge, took some stuff, didn't break anything. So not as likely to be angry or to perceive this creature as a threat and to call Colorado Parks and Wildlife and you know, request something be done about the bear. So then, you know, the more fat Alberts, I mean, the more these bears persist and survive to breeding age, the more you're going to sort of see more, hopefully more fat Alberts, because the bears that are very aggressive, that are aggressive toward people or their pets, or that break in and cause a lot of damage, they, to use the phrasing of the person I was talking to, they're going to get whacked fast. Like some people are going to feel threatened. They're going to complain. They're going to call the agency. The agency's going to come out, set a big covert trap, and that animal will be destroyed. So possibly, yes, possibly, the fat Alberts will be seeing more and more of them and fewer of the aggressive ones. And that could be a good thing over time.
Now, in your section in Fuzz dealing with animals on the highways, you discuss self-driving car solutions to animal strikes. And I found this very fascinating as well. How does it seem that self-driving cars are likely to react to animals on the road in the future?
Well, right now, there's something called a large animal detection system. So an animal that kind of a long-legged, tall animal, anything that comes into the path, the beam of the detector that fits that visual profile will cause the car to stop. The brakes will be applied. And the reason it's a large animal detection system, what they're hoping to prevent is collisions with a moose, an elk, or an elk, because those animals are tall enough that if a car strikes them, it strikes them in the legs and the entire torso and head and antlers. Cartwheels back over the car, and these animals are tall enough that they come through the windshield and land on the driver and or the passenger, and the result is often a broken neck, death or paralysis. So it's quite different than just hitting a deer or the deer's. I mean, there's going to be a lot of damage to the car and to the deer. But often the person survives without serious injury, unless, of course, they swerved and hit a tree and went off the road. So a self-driving car, the ones that I heard about, I called, I think I've talked to someone at Volvo, Volvo and Saab, because there's a lot, they're sold a lot in northern regions, have concerns about hitting moose, because there's a lot of fatalities. But I got curious about small animals, like how does the car decide when it should just plow forward because it's safer to hit a pet than it is to swerve? Or if you stop short for a small animal, then the car behind now smashes into you. How does a car make those decisions? At what point is it safer for the human, for the driver, to just go ahead and hit the raccoon instead of swerving to save the animal's life? And I tried to get an interview with someone at Waymo and a couple of other places, and they didn't want to talk about that. They didn't want to engage on the topic, which leads me to think they haven't quite worked out what to do, because it's situation by situation. The worst thing to do in the case of a small animal on the road with, if there's trees and things on the side of the road, to swerve sharply, and put yourself at risk of going off the road and hitting a tree or a rock or a barrier, that's not what you want to do. But it's also to say, well, our cars will just go ahead and plow into your dog or cat or raccoon. To save your life, we will just be just plowing right on through without even braking or even blinking an eye. So that, that the optics of that are kind of awful, too. So that's a question that I have that as far as I know, hasn't really been answered. I think that the priorities right now, they've got so many other things to figure out before they get down to what do we do about someone's beagle.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of stuff I've read recently, just related in general to self-driving cars. They're just about all the things we do, sometimes just nonsensical risks that we take, be it a risky left-hand turn, or the fact that I'm driving to pick my kid up from school, I might swerve around the chipmunk in the road. And it was, in retrospect, it was dangerous, but also in retrospect, I'm not sure I would have done anything else, how do you translate or improve upon that kind of decision-making in the machine?
Right. And how do you tell a small animal from a kid on a small bicycle? And those fine-grained distinctions, how do you trust the car to make those? It's really tricky. I have a new edition of Stiff coming out, and I with an epilogue where I went back and I talked about what's new in these topics, and one of the things that came up was passenger safety in a self-driving car. If you don't need to be at the steering wheel in a set position, if you can now sit sideways or you know, not, you're not confined as you were as a driver. Well, now in an impact, how do you keep that person safe? Where do you put the airbags if somebody, if people could kind of sit across from each other and you know, you freed people up in the interior of the car, how do you keep them? How do you keep them safe? Where does the airbag go? How do you, you know, how do you configure the seatbelt? So all of that has to be rethought, and probably, you know, the small animal portion of it will be pretty far down the list.
Is there a date for the new edition of Stiff? This is exciting.
Yeah, this week, I think August 31st, the new edition with a snazzy new cover.
Oh, nice.
Comes out. Yeah.
This was, of course, your first big book that kicked it all off.
Yeah, my first book, Stiff, came out in 2003, I think it was. Yeah.
Oh, awesome! Yeah. Yeah. I've read that. I've read all of your books that have come out. They're always a joy.
Oh, thank you. Jeez. I love to hear that.
So, one thing I found interesting about the sections of the book involving humans and animals that come into violent conflict. You have a chapter about leopards in India that intentionally stalk humans as prey repeatedly. They become habituated to this. And it got me wondering, what are some of the broad truths about the difference between animals that sort of stumble into hapless encounters with humans that might turn violent versus animals that deliberately stalk humans as prey?
Yeah, the broad truth is that it's very uncommon for an animal that can easily attack and kill a human to do that. We are not really on the menu. Something has to change. And in the Middle Himalaya, where I was in India, a couple of things happened. One is the theory that Jim Corbett, who was brought in to hunt down some of these kind of famous man-eaters, as he called them, his theory was that during the pandemic of 1917, 1918, there were so many people dying that the traditional ritual of, you know, taking the body to the river and building a pyre and, you know, that wasn't happening. And they would, they came up with a more expedient ritual, which was to put a hot coal in the mouth and send the body off sort of down the hill towards the river, not to actually make the trek and do the whole ritual. And so there were a lot of bodies that were now available, and a leopard will scavenge. His belief was that they developed a taste for human meat that way, and that they then went on to incorporate human meat into their diet going forward. That's a theory that may well be true. The theory of the researcher that I traveled with was it had to do with what's going on in that part of the world, which is a lot of farming communities. The men have given up farming and gone to look for work in the cities. And so there's a lot of rewilding land. It's occupied by people. There are a lot of, you know, women and children left behind there. But there's cover now for animals. There's a lot of brush around homes and in communities in which leopards need to hunt. They will sneak up and then, you know, cover the last distance in a burst of speed and a pounce. So they tend to need to have cover. Also livestock, there isn't being as well tended. So it's kind of it falls prey to the leopards and the people who are watching the livestock sometimes are kids. And I think 41% of the individuals killed by leopards in that region in this once this researcher study were kids under 10. There's opportunities that weren't there for animals that hunt. And sadly, a human or a child or people's pets, they're easier to catch than a deer or a wild pig. So part of it may be leopards just realizing this is an easy dinner.
It seems like a lot of these stories in some way involve rapid changes or modification to the landscape done by humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Yeah, the situation there with elephants, again, surprising to me anyway, number of deaths, 500 deaths a year caused by human deaths caused by elephants. And what's happening there is there's this elephant corridor, as it's called. The elephants tend to move along this path looking for food. It's in, you know, across northern India to the border with Nepal. And these regions are seeing an influx of refugees, and also Terry has built several establishments. There's roads coming through, and the elephants are getting, this is the term, pocketed, stuck in little pockets. And elephants eat a lot. They travel in sizable herds, and they are turning to the farmers' crops for food because they don't have enough food, and they're stuck. They can't keep moving on the way they used to. And so then that's when you have conflict, because you have these villagers who they're depending on this food to survive. You know, it's subsistence farming. And so, you know, a troop of elephants that comes through, even if they don't eat what you're growing, they're going to trample, you know, you get seven or eight elephants that are going to cause a tremendous amount of damage. So people see the elephants coming onto their land, and they'll run out, and they'll try, you know, they're angry and they're upset, and they tend to, there tend to be deaths from getting trampled or knocked over, or an elephant, even if that's not the elephant's intent, it's a very big animal, and it just knocks you with its trunk, it can kill you. And so yes, it's humans moving into the territory and changing the landscape in ways that stymies their natural behaviors and their way of surviving and getting food. You see that also, you know, highways, interstate highways in this country sometimes are put in without taking a look at, well, what animals migrate seasonally to get food, go to a different elevation to get food or to breed, and are we cutting them off? You know, that's a problem. I mean, you can build an overpass, but that's an expensive thing to do. And, you know, much better to look at that beforehand, say, you know, what is the situation here in this swath of land? What kind of wildlife do we have, and how do they move each year seasonally? And is this a bad idea?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think another example of that kind of thing about modification of the landscape and the problems that causes is like poor choices about the relationship between different types of plants or fruit-bearing plants, especially, and settled areas. Like, I think you give the example of, was it in Aspen or somewhere else in Colorado that the city was planting crabapple trees within the city, even while they're trying to solve their bear problem? But then the other thing that stuck with me was, I think you were talking about cabins being like sited at, somebody buy a plot of land and build a cabin right in the middle of a bunch of natural berry trees. So sure. That would be the place where like the bears would already be habituated to coming.
Oh yeah. The crab apples in downtown Aspen. Crab apple, if you've seen a crab apple tree, they're tiny crab apples, but they're almost like, they're clusters of them, kind of like grapes. And the bear just sort of like opens its mouth, you know, and like pulls its mouth down the branch and gets these big mouthfuls. I mean, a crab apple tree is just heaven. You know, if you're an animal looking to get a concentrated food source and lots of calories to put on weight before you hibernate, yeah, you know, crab apple tree, yeah. So the fact that those were planted in downtown, they're pretty when they bloom. Yeah, that's true. They are lovely in the spring. But creating some issues there, and there was even efforts to get them, the city to take them out, and they resisted that, which just seems a little ill advised. But here in the Bay Area, we have a lot up in the hills in Berkeley and Oakland, a lot of deer. So it really behooves you when you do your landscaping to plant plants that deer are not interested in. That is something any good landscaper here will do, is suggest plants that deer don't like. Otherwise, you won't have much landscaping very soon.
And of course, that this all leads to, some people might jump to the conclusion, well, don't we need to kill more of these animals? And that's something you discuss quite a bit, like this idea that sometimes these just elaborate efforts to remove the animals that then just backfire for reasons that you get into in the book. And at one point you refer to, quote, the inside out history of conservation in America, which I think I love the way you put that there, because dealing with how conservation in America is often like tied up in these eradication movements or in the hunting movement. Can you speak to some of that complexity there?
Well, sure. Wilderness conservation came out of a desire to set aside these large pristine tracts of wilderness so that hunters would have a place to hunt. Essentially, they were they were hunt and fish. And they're still, I mean, to this day, we have a lot of government land that is managed by wildlife agencies, and wildlife agencies are funded still by hunting licenses and taxes on equipment. So there is this link. I mean, on the one hand, it is fabulous that these were set aside, that they didn't become agricultural land. I live in California, and if you go out to the Central Valley, there are these little pockets of California as it used to be, these wetlands with these tremendous diversity of bird life, birds stopping over during migration. You have ducks, gadwalls, geese, just like dozens of species. It's a birder's paradise. But there's also little hunting cabins for duck hunters who come, and the land was set aside by and for hunting, but it's also something, for hikers and birders. And it's a weird, I as a bird watcher used to go out there and never knew about the little hunters' cabins. It's kind of like a sort of secret reality of that area and those wetlands. But it really struck me, driving home, going from this really beautiful kind of verdant swath of California, leaving that behind and going out into the more typical Central Valley California, which is just a big flat expanse of big agriculture, of crops. And so, I felt very grateful toward the people who had set this land aside. And, and there is this sort of distance of hunters and birders now. But it is strange to think about the fact that some of our parklands and wilderness areas were originally set aside for people who love to hunt.
But of course, there's still the funding issue here, right? And that's something you get into in the book, that you have these conservation efforts that are still funded by hunting, funded by fishing, et cetera. And I guess in a perfect world, that would all balance out. But there are cases, it seems like, where it raises the question, is this the right approach? Should there not be more federal funding for conservation?
Yeah, I think that there tends to be a mistrust of, if the money's coming from hunting and fishing, isn't there a temptation on the agency's part to put the desires of those of their constituents first? Can we trust them to be unbiased and neutral saviors of the land? There has been talk of separating, making the funding for some of these conservation efforts, federal funding, making it independent of hunting and fishing, creating some sort of body or pool of money that would be earmarked for conservation and just sort of creating some distance between the two. So, that is a concern, and I think it would be great for that to happen.
So here's a question that might be a little odd, but I wonder if you have thoughts about it. How do you think about motive, the concept of motive, differently in a criminal justice context when the perpetrator of a crime is not human? Because a big part of human criminal justice is about understanding and establishing motive, treating crimes differently based on what the motive was or what the perpetrator's understanding was. Thinking about the internal brain states that motivate the attacks of non-human animals, it seems like you could think about them either as like less complex than their human equivalents and thus maybe easier to understand. Often an animal is just feeling threatened in some way or might be hungry. Or you could think about them as maybe more obscure because animals are more alien to our experience and they can't explain their motives in language.
Yeah, the question of motive, it's interesting. In India, that's factored in. The cases are treated differently if it's a predatory attack versus a defensive attack. If there's a series, there's kind of a three strikes rule. If the animal is coming in and preying on livestock or people, that's different from a defensive attack. There, with leopards, there are, as we talked about before, there are predatory attacks where the animal is specifically and intentionally going after a human. But there are tremendous numbers of cases. If you go further south into the tea growing regions, where I also spent some time, in the tea plantations, leopards sometimes sleep under the tea plants because it's shadier and it's cooler. And the tea workers, the pluckers, people plucking the leaves, will sometimes surprise an animal. The animal will like leap up. Sometimes there's an injury, rarely a fatality, but that's a defensive, just an altercation that happened because the person surprised the animal and it felt threatened. So those are considered differently than a predatory attack. So there is that distinction made. You know, here in the U.S., when an animal harms a person, it's considered a public health threat, and it's typically it has crossed a line, regardless of whether the bear was surprised and was defending itself. We tend to not make that same distinction. If it harms or if it kills a person, it will be destroyed. Even if it was the person that had a dog, the dog ran at the bear got upset. The person sort of tried to intervene. The bear turned and attacked the person. You know, there's no trial where we can set forth the reality of the situation and why the bear might have done it and what the situation created and in a sense kind of come at a motive or lack of motive. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in the American context, the way we react to conflict with animals is maybe less understanding of whether or not they might be justified and is more just kind of a pure utilitarian. You know, if an animal has harmed a human or a pet or something, it's just thereafter considered probably dangerous and thus usually is dealt with violently.
Well, yeah, it's a public safety issue. And when the public safety is threatened, the people are going to be the priority, not the animal. I mean, I did talk to a bear researcher who'd spent some time, I believe it was in Nepal, where they have, oh God, now I'm forgetting which species it is. I think they're bears. They're bears that come in and they raid the property and they sometimes get into altercations where someone is injured. And he said to the person in the community who responds to when these attacks happen, he said, if you saw a bear on a person, would you shoot the bear? And the guy said, it's not up to me to decide which life is more important. It was just a different, you know, it's a very different mindset of, you know, the value and the rights of animals versus humans. It doesn't surprise me that we in the United States have the rules that we do. I mean, it's public safety. If your family is being, you know, is in harm's way, then there's going to be agencies that will come in and try to mitigate that threat. That's what we do.
So again, the book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law by Mary Roach. And I want to stress that we didn't ask about anywhere close to all of the animals or scenarios or topics that you discuss in the book. Each chapter, impressed me. There's so much discussed in the book.
It's an unsecured garbage can overflowing with treats.
It is.
Oh, I love that. Can I use that as a blurb on the paperback?
Yes, you can. Full, yeah.
But I thought just for anyone out there, if you were to summarize, like, what is the big take home you want people to have from reading Fuzz? What would that be?
Well, first of all, I want people to know it's a fun read. It's not. I mean, sometimes talking about these things, it can seem like a bit of a downer. It's mm-hmm. animals that are sometimes ending up being destroyed. I try to keep things entertaining and light, and there's lots of room for that in this book. But as a takeaway, I just hope that people have a tendency to just, especially since we use the words pest and nuisance, and I do use the word nuisance in the book as well. We have this tendency to immediately, when we've got an animal coming onto our property, doing something we don't want it to do, we want to just pick up the phone and call someone and make it go away. And there's things that prevent any further damage. There's you can exclude the animal. You can call someone who actually has the welfare of the animal in mind. And the Humane Society of the United States has a great webpage, Species by Species. Here's some things to do to resolve the problem without harming or killing the animal. So not to be all on a soapbox or anything, but just to try to calm down and think about what you might do before you call the wildlife control operator to set a trap and let it go in a park, and which it's not supposed to do, et cetera, or set a trap and or put out a very glue trap. I can't believe they even sell those anymore. So that's not a very short takeaway, is it? But that's what I guess I'd like people to just to think before they act a little bit, I guess.
Well, and I do want to concur that the book is very fun and very funny. Like all your books, I laughed, but I also felt sad at times. It made me think about things in a new way. So I essentially felt all the feels, as the young people say.
Fully concur.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thanks for taking time out of your day to come on the show and discuss the book.
Totally. Oh, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks once more to Mary Roach for taking time out of her day to come on the show and chat with us. Her website, if you want to learn more about her and her work, is maryroach.net. And as mentioned in the episode, there's also this new edition of Stiff out now as well with new cover art. So look for that. If you've never read it, this will be a great Halloween season to pick it up, or spook for that matter. Both of those, I think, would make for tremendous Halloween seasonal reads. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Look for the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We have core science episodes on Tuesday and Thursday, artifact episodes on Wednesday, listener mail on Mondays. Friday is our time to cut loose and talk about a weird film with Weird House Cinema, and then on the weekend, you get a rerun.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you.